For our COBT viewers and listeners, it's Maynard, Mike, and Todd here with something we're really excited about. Pavel Molchanov is here. He's a managing director in the Raymond James research effort. And in particular, he's head of their renewable energy and clean technology vertical. We're super excited to talk about so many things. In the lead-in, Pavel was nice enough to say this is an AMA program, which is Ask Me Anything, so we're super excited. But you'll hear it from Pavel, but his background in clean energy really started in 2006, so he has been doing this a long, long time. I know Mike's going to fuss at me for saying clean energy. Energy is not always clean. It's not always dirty. There's many trade-offs. We know that. Thank you, Mike. But look, there's over 300 stocks in that renewable energy clean technology space. And so having Pavel here to talk with us about all those stocks, about those investors, about those trends and technologies is really exciting. Pavel, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're excited about this AMA format that you came up with. Ask Me Anything. Mike, what would you throw into the discussion before we get serious with Pavel?
Yeah, let's really discuss what's going on in the markets today, you know, kind of to discuss traditional energy, fossil fuel type commodities, and then we'll talk a little bit about, you know, sort of alternative energy right at the end. But just from a lead-in standpoint, you know, with today's going, you know, the biggest news is that there looks to have been a tentative debt ceiling deal over the weekend, and you would have thought the markets would have been rallying on that, but they're not rallying on that because it doesn't look like a deal sealed at this point in time. It looks like the Republicans are raising a big stink about this, so we're not across the finish line. And so we've said for the last three or four weeks, when we get a deal, we'll probably see a temporary lift in markets. But you know, like I said, it's going to be temporary because there's a lot of issues that need to be worked out, you know, with that. Because of this, you know, because the deal was really not sealed yet, I think what you're seeing is crude oil pulled back about $3 a barrel today because there's some concerns there. You know, the one thing we'd say also too about crude oil markets is that we're going to have a June 4th OPEC meeting coming up here next week. And if you listen to what's been going on in the last week, you've heard Saudi's oil minister saying, you know, watch out, you know, speculators, we could pull something on you. And then Russia comes out last week and says there's not going to be any cuts at this OPEC meeting. And the only point I'd make is that those two parties seem like they've been on the same, you know, on the same side, and they look to be saying different things at this point in time. And so instead of Saudi really being, you know, focused on oil speculators, they need to get focused on Russia's actions. Russia really hasn't been cutting oil as much as they said. And so, you know, they're in unity right now, but we'll see how this this meeting coming up will probably be one of the bigger meetings in a while, I think. You know, so we'd say that. And, you know, the other thing that we say is, you know, from a pipeline standpoint today, you know, Equitrans is up around 35% today because were included in this debt deal to get this Mountain Valley Pipeline approved. And that's a great thing because, you know, we've been hearing some of these Appalachian guys have been wanting a pipeline for quite a while. If this gets built, this is going to be coming on later this year, early next year. That's going to help differentials in that area, and it's going to move, you know, some gas out of the area. So that's a pretty good thing. The last thing we'd kind of, you know, figure is, you know, we talk about with Pavel coming on is really comparing, you know, the S&P Energy Index versus the ICL, which is a global, you know, clean energy ETF, and just give you an idea of what it's done over the last 1 year, 2 years, and 3 years. Over the last year, the ICLN is down about 8%, and the S&P Energy is down about 7%. So roughly the same on a total return basis. Over the last 2 years, the ICLN is down about 18% on a total return basis. Energy is up 62%. And over the last 3 years, the ICLN is up about 60%. But energy is up about 130%. So one of the things we want to talk about, Pavel, today is, you know, what's happening here? Why the divergence? What he's seeing, you know, with energy, you know, traditional energy guys, new energy guys. So we'll go ahead and just save that for the conversation in a few minutes.
All right. Awesome. Well, Pavel, welcome. We're going to jump in. And you were kind enough to say, ask me anything. I think, you know, I referenced it in the lead-in. You've been looking at alternative energy or renewable, you know, clean tech. You've been doing this for quite a long time. As you reflect on it, and it's really striking because most people are newer to it, haven't been doing it as long as you have. As you reflect on your career in it, what are some of the big picture observations you uh, you have as you think back on all your time doing this?
Sure. Look, energy transition is a megatrend that is becoming more and more powerful. The term energy transition was practically not even used 17 years ago when I started writing about sustainability. 2006, you know, when I started this, this was before the, 9 years before the Paris Agreement. So even before the Copenhagen Agreement, which a lot of people forget at this point. So, big picture, fossil fuels are still growing on an absolute basis, but declining as a percentage of the overall energy mix. And there will come a time, sooner or later, when fossil fuels begin to decline in absolute terms. You know, we can debate exactly when that happens, but it will happen. It's only a matter of time. Point number two, just because renewable and low carbon energy solutions are growing rapidly, it does not mean that, you know, every stock is a buy. And it does not mean that every company is seeing, you know, massive amounts of profitability. Because the flip side of the rapid growth and expansion is commoditization. Commoditization is not a dirty word. Commoditization in many ways is a good thing, because it is how these newer energy sources are becoming more cost competitive. Here is an example. When I started writing about solar in 2006, the price of a PV module, solar panel, is $3 a watt. Today, it's 19 cents, 1-9. Can you think of anything else in energy that is 95% cheaper than it used to be? Oil's not 95% cheaper. Natural gas is not 95% cheaper. We need to bear this in mind. Commoditization is the corollary of cost reduction. Companies are growing top line, but in many cases, margins are not as high as they used to be, because a lot of those savings are being passed on to the end user. And the third kind of big picture theme I want to talk about is the role of public policy. There is sometimes a perception, and particularly in the oil and gas community, that if it were not for government subsidies or mandates, nobody would want renewable and clean energy. That's just not true. Now, for one thing, as I mentioned, dramatic cost reduction. In some verticals, more dramatic than in others. So I certainly want to be clear, there is an important role to play for government policy in stimulating demand for and pushing energy transition. But it is not the end all and be all, not even close. And economic rationale plays a role. There is also an increasingly powerful ESG rationale, where businesses and, on a smaller scale, individuals are trying to reduce their carbon footprint, not because the government is forcing them to do it, because they want to do it. They want to do it individually. So those are some high-level themes, and we can zoom in on any of that.
No, that's fantastic. And I mentioned up front, we were so excited to have you. And after your lead-in, I'm particularly excited to have you. I can tell we're going to get into some great topics. Maybe one question for you. You certainly hear a lot about ESG, and the effect that had on the classic or traditional energy companies. When you think about ESG and your universe, at some level, and I'll just throw it out, at some level, demand is coming into that space because people want the quote ESG stocks. But at the same time, those same companies have their own ESG pressures, right? Like, where do you make your panels? How do you tell me about your production processes? Tell me about your governance. Like, talk to us about ESG in the context of your coverage universe.
ESG is not only the E. Yeah, let's put that on the table right up front. Just because an energy source is more environmentally friendly does not mean it's perfect. So, you know, you noted, you know, supply chain dynamics need to be looked at. You know, for example, electric vehicles require cobalt. Where is cobalt made? 2/3 of the world's cobalt is mined in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's one of the poorest countries in the world, with significant problems with child labor, for example. This is not a great place to mine cobalt, but that's where it comes from disproportionately. So, is that a problem? Absolutely. Likewise, a large chunk of the world's polysilicon, just the basic building block of solar panels, comes from Xinjiang province in China, where the Muslim community has been oppressed by the government for a long time. And that's a serious issue. And, you know, we can come up with other examples. Now, all that being said, the number one environmental issue for all of us to address is carbon emissions. And there is no question that electric vehicles have a better emissions footprint than internal combustion engines. Just like there is no question that a solar farm or a wind farm is a lot better from a climate perspective than burning coal or even burning natural gas.
Could I ask you a quick question on that? Because it's such a fascinating thing. It seems like, and this is if I'd call it a dividing line, but when you focus, like you just did, when you say climate is the number one issue and then you solve for emissions and rank things like that versus thinking about all environmental issues and solving for what choices might we make. Is the dividing line between those two the severity of the climate crisis and whether or not you think it needs to be solved within 10 years or 20 years or 30 years? Those are two lenses that do bring you to some different answers sometimes. I'm curious if you can help us understand that.
Right. Yeah. And I made the point that, you know, nothing in life is perfect, right? We have to make choices. So, you know, solar panels, you know, coming out of China can be associated with human rights violations. That's true. And, you know, hydropower, building large dams, can damage fisheries. Nuclear power has a problem with radioactive waste. All of those are absolutely real issues. That being said, what we know from climatologists, when I'm specifically looking to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, which is kind of the gold standard of guidance on this issue, that the the single greatest challenge facing humanity is tackling the climate crisis, which means cutting emissions. So all of these targets that you hear about, net zero, carbon neutrality, right? That's carbon emissions. Within that umbrella, we have to make choices because, as I said, nothing in life is perfect. You know, we cannot derive energy from, you know, Hershey's Kisses. The geography, the, you know, kind of site-specific attributes can help determine, you know, what the best, you know, or the optimal options are for energy production in any given, you know, community or location. But as a general premise, to get to, you know, anywhere near net zero emissions by mid-century, which is what climate scientists tell us needs to happen, the amount of fossil fuel consumption needs to be vastly reduced from current levels. Not, you know, not to zero. Like, there will still be airplanes flying, you know, burning jet fuel, I'm sure, in 2050. And there will still be, you know, natural gas, I suspect, used in, you know, heating homes and factories. But it's not going to be as big as they are today. And in particular, coal. To get to net zero by mid-century, coal needs to be wiped out. Even in China and India. That is the low-hanging fruit, is eliminating coal from the electricity mix. Then tackling oil consumption, tackling natural gas consumption. Those are important too, but coal is sort of climate enemy number one, so to speak.
So one thing on that, Pavel, you are providing, there's so many ways we could take this. So thank you for getting us going here. On coal, just to take that one for example, it does seem like replacing, well, first of all coal is not the same, right? A new coal plant is very different than one that was built 50 years ago that's still in use. So there's considerations there. Replacing coal with natural gas, generally speaking, that's a winner. That's how we have reduced emissions in the U.S. But the idea of eliminating coal in 27 years, when you say it like that, how, when you think about that, we have to go on a nuclear building frenzy. We would have to really embrace natural gas. Like, how would we conceivably do that? I just want to put the spotlight on that one, because it's just the idea of no more coal by 2050. I'm struggling with the math.
Coal is the, on a unit for unit basis, the number one culprit behind CO2 emissions. And furthermore, coal is actually easier to get rid of than oil or natural gas. Getting rid of oil is going to be, you know, is going to take, you know, longer than 2050, because there are, you know, internal combustion engines and vehicles, or, you know, certainly smaller vehicles can be replaced by electric. But it's very difficult to, you know, displace, you know, long haul, you know, diesel and long haul trucking, and in marine shipping, and in aircraft. I think these will continue to be sources of oil demand, you know, well into the second half of the century. Coal absolutely is realistic to eliminate entirely. It probably will not be completely gone by 2050 globally, right? I think China, I'm sure, will be still burning some coal in 2050, But if it's significantly lower than it is today, that's a good start. And I fully expect that on in both the U.S. and Europe, there will be zero coal-fired electric generation well before 2050, in fact. So globally, coal is about 30% of electricity. That percentage in the U.S., it's now 20%. It used to be 50, by the way, not that long ago. In Europe, it's now 11%. And that's coming down very rapidly. So there is a roadmap for how coal can be eliminated from the, or almost eliminated from the electricity mix. I don't attempt to forecast things out to 2050. That would be a bit silly right now. But directionally, it will be a lot lower than 30%. It would not surprise me if it's in the single digits by that point. The replacement of coal needs to be an all of the above story. Will nuclear play a role? Yes. Absolutely. In Asia and the Middle East, there are new reactors being built today. Will wind and solar play a role? Obviously, those are the fastest growing sources of electricity all around the world. In some places, New Zealand, Iceland, Costa Rica, geothermal. In some places, Denmark, the UK, bioenergy, wood pellets can play a role. Hydro, it will continue to be an important source of electricity, although I do not expect hydro to grow because rising temperatures means there is less water going through dams and therefore reduces the productivity of hydropower. And natural gas? Natural gas is a much cleaner source of electricity than coal. It is a fossil fuel. And there are parts of the world, North America prime among them, where natural gas is so cheap and so plentiful that it will continue to be used on a large scale for a long time. On the other hand, I highly doubt that Europe will be using natural gas to generate electricity by 2050. That's something that, the war has probably accelerated. In other words, if it were not for the war and the resulting energy crisis, Europe would still be using a lot of low-cost Russian gas. And of course, that's now, for obvious reasons, off the table. LNG plays a role in Europe. But LNG is very pricey, as we know. And I think many European governments will say, look, the sooner we can reduce our dependence on imported natural gas from anywhere, including LNG, the better off economically we'll be.
So, Pavel, as you think about all those moving pieces that you just went through, particularly, coal is such a cheap source of energy if you have a lot of it. So India, China, those places. But when you think about eliminating something that's that cheap and swapping it into things which right now are not cheaper, and you think about the scale of what we're describing here in terms of the world's global energy system, do you think it is an inescapable conclusion that over the next 20 years that the world's energy will just be more expensive? Or how do you think about the cost side of this, and how do you think about what that might mean for economic development? Because that's obviously just a huge change in the stack. And you were talking about coal as a percent of electricity, but then there's just kind of total energy consumption, which is the even, you know, bigger piece of the pie.
Coal is cheap in that, you know, the raw material is low cost. But coal-fired power plants are very inefficient, poor efficiency at converting that coal feedstock into energy. So, you know, again, I go back to what one of my earlier points. It's not just about government policies. Yes, in you know, we've seen, you know, the UK phasing out coal by 2025, Germany trying to phase out coal by 2030, and so on. We do not have a coal phase out in this country. I guarantee you, Joe Manchin would never vote for such a thing. Okay, that's not going to happen, certainly not at the federal level. And yet, coal in this country went from 50% of electricity to 20% in the last decade and a half. Cheap gas played an important role in that. Cheap wind played a role, and solar is increasingly playing a role. So again, all of the above. It's not a, you know, one size fits all solution. In China, coal used to be about 3/4 of electricity. It's now 60%, which is still a lot, and of course, you know, of a larger number. But it's down from 75% to 60. Again, there is no phase out of coal in China. But nonetheless, China is installing half of the world's wind, half of the world's solar, building lots of nuclear. It adds up. And I'll also point out that the cost of the traditionally coal was a low cost fossil fuel. I think the war has changed that. Before the war, coal was generally below $100 a ton. And now, because access to Russian coal has been, you know, wiped out, coal is now between $150 and $200 a ton. So roughly double what it was, you know, two or three years ago. Know, maybe that price will cool off, but it's certainly more expensive than it used to be. And in any case, we need to keep in mind that it is not only cost is not the only variable that matters, as important as it is. You know, what also matters a lot is security and resilience. So think about those countries in Europe that were lulled into comfort for years and years buying Russian gas and even cheaper Russian coal. And then all of a sudden, the Kremlin began to weaponize energy last summer, and those markets were completely cut off. And this is why Europe experienced the energy crisis that it did last year. It's not only political, so there's political risk. Let's think about Brazil. Brazil gets half of its electricity from hydro. Now, there's no political risk in that. But guess what? Rising temperatures means water scarcity. And water scarcity means those hydroelectric dams will be less and less productive over time. So in Brazil, and you know, we've seen this in California, we've seen this in British Columbia, when there is a drought, people lose electric power. There's not enough electricity to go around because of drought, because of heat waves. We saw this in Europe, in Norway, last summer, for example. So diversification of energy is not just about making things cheaper. In fact, in some cases, I would argue it is worthwhile to pay more for greater security of energy supply, because none of us want to wake up one day and figure out, oh, our community just lost electricity because of a climate issue or because of a political issue.
Just hold that thought, because that was such a great thought, which is you said it might be worth pay a little more, basically to know that you have power, that you're assured. And that question right there is at the heart of what's going on with the grid in almost every part of the OECD world, right? Which is, we have added things which are very cheap, marginal costs on the marginal basis, but sometimes they're not available, right? And so to have a grid which, to your words, might cost a little more, but be more dependable, would be worth it. Do you think what you were just said, does it apply? How do we apply what you just said to power, and how do we blend power systems together? Let's use the U.S. as an example, so that we do have reliable power and get away from the, you know, because intermittency, I guess it could be a dam, or it could be solar, or it could be wind, or it could be some plant that's offline. Like, how do we get the world to embrace what you just said? Because we do need reliable power.
As I said earlier, all of the above solution. The fact of the matter is, you know, coal is losing ground in the electricity business. Again, it's, you know, even true in China, and it's very, very true on both sides of the Atlantic. Nuclear is also losing ground, you know, partly because almost nobody is building nuclear reactors outside of China and a few Middle Eastern countries. Those are baseload sources of electricity, so they're losing share in the mix. And what's gaining share in the mix, as you noted, is more intermittent sources. So that is a manageable problem that has a technical solution, and the solution is to improve the electric grid, to upgrade and modernize the electric grid. The electric grid, I'll provide a little bit of a tangent here, is the most arguably antiquated industry on the planet. The electric grid in many communities is not much different from what it was 100 years ago. It is very centralized. In other words, you know, you have large power plants that somewhere outside of the, you know, in the rural areas outside of the cities. And those big plants are connected with, you know, high voltage transmission lines. And then those transmission lines, you know, lead to a transformer. The current is stepped down, distributed to the individual homes and businesses. A lot like what Thomas Edison designed a century ago. This needs to be modernized. One way to modernize the electric grid is to make it smarter. What does that mean? Leverage the opportunities of information technology, the internet, communications architecture, software, potentially even AI, very hot buzzword these days. Making the grid smarter is not just about installing smart meters, even though that's sort of a building block, but it's about, you know, there are different solutions you hear about. You know, there's something called distribution automation, there is something called virtual power plants. There are some, you know, analytics software that can be deployed, power line communication, you know, a lot of these kind of emerging technology solutions. This is not about how electricity is generated. It's about how it is transmitted. And we also need to think about how it is stored. So power storage. Now, that wind farm, everybody knows wind doesn't always blow, sun doesn't always shine. Okay, that happens. But there are other times when there is too much wind anybody who's familiar with West Texas will appreciate that. So the solution is to store electricity. And this is another great example of where costs have really come down. Not quite 95%, the way I talked about solar a little bit earlier, you know, but the cost of a lithium-ion battery, you know, compared to 2010, is down by more than two-thirds. And lithium-ion batteries can be used in electric vehicles. They can also be used for these large systems to store electricity on the grid. So that's another solution. The last thing that needs to happen with the grid is it needs to become more distributed. That means enabling consumers and businesses to generate power where they live, at the point of use. And that can mean rooftop solar on people's homes. Only 4% of Americans have that today. In Australia, by the way, that's 25%. Shows you what's possible. It can also mean putting fuel cells next to a data center. You know, data centers are not just for AI. There have always been data centers. As long as the internet has existed, data centers use very large amounts of electricity, and they can never afford to shut down. They need to operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So data centers are what we call mission critical. They need their own electricity backup, because when the grid shuts down, no IT company wants to disrupt its data center work. So this is also an example of the more distributed the grid is, the more stable it will become.
Yeah, the question I have, Pavel, is, we start out talking about, S&P Energy performance versus the ICLN, and it wasn't to say, to show that energy's been so much better. It was to point out that in my point, 3 or 4 years ago, there was a big transition of energy analysts, energy hedge fund managers, generalists, out of traditional energy because we had to get another thing because it was cool. It was going up every day. And that seems to have come back where people are saying, we don't have enough people in traditional energy, analysts, PMs, et cetera. What are you guys seeing both internally and what are you seeing with, just energy fund managers? Where were they? Where are they now? What do you think they'll be in a couple of years from now?
In that 1 year, 2 year, 3 year calculation, we need to think about the starting point, which 3 years ago, that was the depths of the COVID crisis, right? We all remember the spring of 2020, right? What did oil prices do? In the spring of 2020, negative $30 a barrel at one point for WTI, as I recall. Brent didn't quite turn negative, but we remember what happened. So from that near-death experience, oil stock, oil prices, obviously, and oil stocks naturally had very powerful, recovery since then. In the past year, of course, a year ago, oil peaked in the early part of the war, $120 a barrel. Now it's come down. With clean tech, 2020 was by far the best year for clean tech stocks ever. The average clean tech stock in 2020 tripled. Yes, tripled. And that was too much. Was it a bubble? Absolutely. People remember the NASDAQ bubble? This was a clean tech bubble. It was just 2.5-3 years ago. So from that very frothy level, just about everything in clean tech has come down. And rightly so. Because again, these things were getting overcooked. You know, and we can obviously, you know, look at even longer history if anybody wants to. All of that is, you know, kind of interesting, and you know, we can do these comparisons, but regardless of how these stocks perform in any given quarter or even any given year, the fact of the matter is the investability of cleantech has never been greater. And there are 300, I think this number was mentioned a little bit earlier, there are 300 publicly traded cleantech companies with a U.S. listing. Not all of them are U.S.-based, right? Plenty of them are from China, some from Europe, Canada, Brazil, India. There are 300 stocks. You know, Tesla, right, at the top, down to over 100 of these companies below $1 billion market cap. So it's a very broad universe. Pre-COVID, it was about 200. So another way to frame that is one third of every cleantech stock that currently trades in the United States went public in the COVID era, in the last 3.5 years. So the overall universe has never been more investable. But as I said, you know, making money in this stuff is not easy. You know, with oil, you know, if you get the commodity right, you'll make money in oil stock. If you're right, if the commodity is going up. With cleantech, there's no benchmark commodity or anything of that sort to look at. A lot of it is really, it's stock picking, and we have to kind of zoom in on individual industries and within each industry, individual companies with their own distinct business models. So it's a very, very important to take a selective approach, because you know, all of these kind of index values that you pointed to, it's a rule of thumb, but in reality, there are big winners and there are big losers and everything in between.
You hit two buzzwords that really caught my attention: investability and basically business model. And I would say that traditional energy, the reason it's outperformed, yes, crude oil prices went up, gas prices went up, but they changed the business model. The business model became a return of capital business model after many, many years. And I look at, alternative energy right now. It seems to me the reason why they're coming down, yeah, they went up a lot, but now interest rates went up a lot. The cost of capital went up a lot. If you look at Shell and BP and some of these other guys, they were really big into, alternative. They still are, but they've backed off a little bit. And I guess it really now boils down to, hey, you know what? We have to generate returns. Is that true? I mean, are you hearing that from generalist investors and hedge funds that are investing in this group? You know what? We need to see business models that generate decent returns or we're not going to fund these.
You are exactly right that in the oil and gas industry, the pivot to capital discipline and free cash flow generation has been an important shift in the kind of the psychology of the industry. That's absolutely true. Of course, oil and gas is also a much more mature industry, right? Nobody expects global oil volumes to grow 10% a year, right? That will never happen. Global electric vehicle sales are growing 30% a year. Global solar new builds are growing 10 to 15% a year. Well, hydrogen is probably doubling from green hydrogen from a small base. So very different growth rates, different level of development in these adoption curves. With, as I said, with growth comes commoditization. So when clean tech companies miss estimates for earnings, they almost never miss because of top line. They miss because of margin, right? You know, revenue is the easy part. You know, you make solar panels, you make EVs, you make hydrogen fuel cells. You can sell everything you make. That's not the hard part. It's about, you know, getting margin to drop down to the bottom line, because yeah, it's competitive and everybody wants to squeeze out every bit of cost to drive adoption, right? I mean, the goal for so many of these companies is to displace some portion of fossil fuel consumption. And to do that, they need to be more and more cost competitive. So that's the, you know, that's kind of the trade-off. A lot of growth, but you know, a lot of commoditization and margin pressure. There is also those are the fundamental drivers. And then just in terms of how the stocks trade day to day. A lot of that has to do with the risk tolerance of the investment community at any given point in time. In 2020, in the early part of COVID, growth at any price, right? In 2020, all the tech stocks were up, going through the roof. It was the growth at any price. Clean tech was part of that. Not the only part. More recently, because of higher interest rates, because of inflationary dynamics, a lot of supply chain complications, sentiment on anything that's kind of risky, high beta, has noticeably soured. That's absolutely true. I think the most important lesson for anybody who's listening, who runs, happens to run a private company and is thinking about going public, I'll just give you a bit of unsolicited advice. You need to make sure that your business model is validated commercially before you endeavor to become a public company. Take it from me. It has not been a pleasant experience for pre-revenue, pre-commercial companies that managed to become public, but are now struggling. And maybe they went public at $10 a share. Their stock is now at $2 or $1 or 50 cents. Why? Because they have not validated their business model. And things inevitably, take longer than expected, cost a little more, you have to issue more, raise more capital. That's a hard game to win when you're a public company. In the public market, it's very important to have a commercially validated business model. That means actual revenue from actual customers. Whatever your solution may be, is it making solar panels, or is it installing solar panels, or is it something a lot more obscure like carbon capture or small nuclear reactors? Whatever it is, you need to have a commercially validated business model before going public. Otherwise, it's not going to be a pleasant experience. You do not have to be profitable, by the way. But you need to have actual revenue from actual customers.
Hey, Pavel, I'll jump in here real quick. When you look at the breadth of the kind of companies you are covering and tracking, you've got power storage, wind and solar, you've got hydrogen, water, biomaterials. I mean, energy transition is pretty broad. Is there a sector in there that you feel like isn't getting enough attention? Like people should be talking about this flavor a little bit more than the other flavors? And then alternatively, is there one that you look at and you say, I'm just not so sure about this one. I wish I never had to think about this one, or I wish I didn't have to mess with this one quite as much. When you look at the whole menu, is there a place where you wish a little more emphasis was being placed right now?
Sure. And look, as I said, it needs to be all of the above, because depending on the particular application, the particular geography, right, you know, whatever the kind of use case may be, it's a very broad, you know, diverse landscape, and it needs to be that way, because there's no one silver bullet to enabling the transition to carbon neutrality. It really will take absolutely everything. There are a few very obscure, below the radar verticals that, until the last 3 years, had zero publicly traded companies. So, you know, there were some venture-backed startups, and there still are, of course, nothing publicly traded. So I mentioned, you know, small nuclear reactors. Small in this case means nuclear reactors that can be installed next to a mining site, for example, to provide electricity for that mining operation, or, you know, potentially at a military base. There's only one company publicly traded called NuScale Power. And 2 years ago, it was privately held. And there's nobody else in the public market today. Again, they're venture-backed startups. Some of our listeners may be familiar with Fusion Power. Fusion Power is even more of a proverbial science experiment than small modular reactors. There are no fusion power companies today in the public domain. They're all venture-backed startups. Companies like Commonwealth Fusion, for example, in Massachusetts. This is very interesting, extremely early stage. If anybody builds a fusion reactor commercially before the end of this decade, I will be very impressed. But you know what? It's exciting, and we'll be seeing more headlines about it. But I will say that not everything needs to be this exotic. For example, there are companies involved in energy efficiency. Energy efficiency might not even sound like a separate vertical in clean tech, because it's almost too obvious, right? Of course, using less energy makes sense, right? You know, the less energy you make, the less energy you need, the more money you save. I mean, it's common sense. It's difficult to invest in energy efficiency because so many of the businesses involved in it are parts of, you know, giant organizations. So there's a whole set of companies called ESCOs, ESCOs, which stands for energy service companies. These are contractors that deploy and manage efficiency upgrades for buildings or sets of entire, you know, campuses. So many of the ESCOs are parts of, you know, big utilities like Exelon in the United States or Centrica in Britain, or they're parts of large industrial conglomerates like Honeywell in the United States or Schneider Electric in France. My personal favorite, Lockheed Martin. You know, who knew that the world's largest defense contractor can weatherize your windows for you? But it can. So it's not easy. So there are a few standalone companies that are focused on energy efficiency. There's a company called Ameresco that is derives most of its revenue from upgrading energy at government buildings, universities, schools, some, you know, commercial high rises. But it's not easy. You know, there's certainly not, you know, not enough of these investable choices for people to invest in energy efficiency. On the other hand, you asked, you know, what is perhaps overcooked or overhyped in some sense. Look, electric mobility is extremely exciting. And of course, the, you know, the fact that Elon Musk is generating more headlines than probably, you know, almost any human being on the planet helps to explain why EVs get so much attention. But there are 50 publicly traded EV companies today in the United States, 50. And that number at the beginning of COVID was about 10. So it's skyrocketed since then. It's very crowded. You know, the EV market, of course, it's big, and it will continue to grow more so in Europe and China than the US, I might add, but you know, growing everywhere. But it's also, it is so many choices for investors that frankly it's difficult to figure out, you know, do we like company A better than company B? And there are, you know, 50 of these things to choose from.
One follow up from me, and then I'll turn it back to Maynard. But you think of the IRA, it seems like for a bunch of these sectors that you cover is a huge tailwind, right? A huge amount of money, you know, coming in, helping those. Are there any headwinds, you know, for a lot of these? And I was thinking recently of the Texas legislature talking about, you know, renewable development and what they're trying to incent and maybe not incent. But are there other factors out there, whether there are public policy like that, supply chain issues, you know, material, you know, mineral constraints? Are there other headwinds that, you know, listeners should be thinking about as they start wading into this broader space?
Yeah. And I made the point that public policy is valuable, but it is not the end all and be all. So in Washington, the Inflation Reduction Act, in Europe, the European Climate Law, which goes back to 2021. By the way, the United States, interestingly enough, despite the Inflation Reduction Act, is the only major industrialized economy without a legally binding net zero mandate. And China and India do not have that either, but you know, they're not, we don't consider them major industrialized economies. So every other, you know, Europe, Canada, Japan, Korea, Australia, they all have it. So the US does not have the best energy transition policies, not by a long shot. I mean, the most effective energy transition policies are in general in the European Union and the UK. But the Inflation Reduction Act certainly was useful. I should also add, a lot of energy policy in the United States is managed by states. So you know, there are some important differences between, you know, sort of California on one hand and, you know, Florida on the other, for example. All that being said, there are hurdles to clean energy adoption that apply anywhere in the world, regardless of, you know, what happens with government policy. Supply chain issues, obviously, during COVID, with, you know, lockdowns, labor shortages, those things are more or less in the rearview mirror. I don't think we're going to need to worry about going back to that. But you know, that certainly that happened not long ago. More kind of thinking ahead, permitting can be challenging. You know, it can be difficult to get a pipeline permitted or in an oil field. But you might be surprised how difficult it sometimes is to get a solar farm permitted. Right? Solar farms, they don't leak. They don't blow up. But getting a permit in some jurisdictions can be time consuming. You know, and I won't even get into nuclear. I mean, that's a whole nother discussion. Likewise, there can be complications in protectionism. This is a good example of how the government gives with one hand, takes away with the other. There's a lot of economic nationalism around the world. Not only in the United States. We've seen this in India. We've seen, countries like Brazil have local content rules that go back, many, many years. So building projects or developing factories is made more difficult and more expensive when you have to, you're obligated to use equipment, technologies that are locally, sourced, right? Sometimes there are mandates, sometimes there are tariffs, different kinds of rules, but protectionism, you can ask, plenty of solar developers who found, all of the tariffs out of Washington very annoying, going back to, in some cases, the Obama era. So this is all to say we need to be mindful of these hurdles to adoption, and to the extent that things take longer than expected, this is why.
Pavel, this has been fascinating. I hate to wrap up because I think all of us have more things we could talk to you about. Maybe one final one is, as you think about the Raymond James franchise, it's a storied franchise, so successful, and one of the things that is the hallmark of the franchise is retail investors. It's not an institutional investor or organization. And we associate institutional investors with ESG and with a lot of things that have been driving capital flows. Would you mind talking about the that Raymond James retail investor base and how it shows up in your business and how it leads you to what are the types of questions you get? I just think that's an interesting aspect of the franchise that we ought to ask you for some of that sentiment or color that you get.
First of all, thank you for those kind words. So I'll just clarify, Raymond James deals with a very broad range of clients, including just about all of the institutional investment funds, a lot of corporate clients, but you're right. There is a legacy. Raymond James is really built on a foundation of serving the retail investing public through thousands and thousands of financial advisors who work with individual families and households. As kind of zooming out for a moment. The investment funds that make active decisions, right? So we're not talking about in the index funds, right? That manage money actively frequently do it on behalf of the retail investing public, right? Who owns mutual funds? Right? You and me. On mutual funds, hedge funds are generally for kind of a higher net worth demographic, but nonetheless, there are we can think of retail investors putting money into hedge funds as well. So all of this is to say that the kind of big picture trends in terms of, you know, what investors are interested in and what they're excited about, it's not really any sort of, you know, dividing line between institutional and retail. I mean, a lot of these things point in the same direction. So the fact that energy transition is one of these mega trends, along with AI, right? You know, and robotics and other exciting stuff, life science. Now, there are various mega trends. Energy transition is not the only one, but it is a big one. This is something that every investor needs to at least understand. And that doesn't mean in all cases, you know, buying clean tech stocks. It can mean that, or it might, you know, lead people to make other decisions. But I think having the right information is really vital. And what folks like me try to do is just, you know, provide the context. Stock picking, is hard, and we don't always get it right. But what we can do, hopefully, is even when we get the stocks wrong, at least provide some messages that our, you know, listeners and readers can use to, you know, help make sense of the world around them. And energy is so central to the way the economy functions. Understanding how the energy markets are evolving over time, I'm convinced is absolutely vital. And this is why I'm delighted to have had this conversation with you. So thank you very much.
Well, Pavel, we really appreciate your time. We look forward to staying in touch. And for all our viewers, we'll provide some more information about you. But I know they all really enjoyed getting a chance to hear you talk about all these things. So thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All righty. Thanks, all.